are Florida's water wars heating up? Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and now subscribe to that daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we will take your calls on the fight over water withdrawals in the St. John's River. What are your questions? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, helping local college students of Hispanic descent achieve their dreams of success. Plus, our own travel expert Judy Wells with tips on traveling overseas. All of that ahead. But first this morning, it's called the Central Florida Water Initiative, a plan to withdraw hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the St. John's River. It's something officials here in Jacksonville fiercely object to. Massive growth and development down in the Orlando area, that's what's behind the water withdrawals. But what are the ripple effects? Well, Brian Teeple is executive director of the Northeast Florida Regional Council. He's been following this, and he joins us now in studio with more about the state's fight over water. Brian, a pleasure as always. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And here's our question to callers. When it comes to Florida's water wars, what are your questions? Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And so for years now, actually, this has been going on. Central Florida has been angling to withdraw increasing amounts of water from the St. John's River, which flows through our area and the Orlando area. But with growth continuing to skyrocket in the Orlando metro region, the demands for more water keep increasing. Why is this, in your view, such a point of contention?
Well, you know, the Central Florida area has grown so rapidly over the last number of years. The water management district down there figured out that they had pretty much given away permits for all the groundwater which was available. So they start looking for alternative sources. The river is an easy target, and it's one of those areas that, as you say, has been going on for a number of years, and it seems to be increasing in volume at this point in time.
The St. John's Riverkeeper, our local North Florida environmental group, Mayor Lenny Curry, have written letters blasting these river withdrawals. This is not new, going as far back as John Payton's mayoral administration. There have been strong objections to this coming from up here in North Florida. It's really, there's a turf battle going on, isn't there, Brian?
Well, there's a turf battle, but I think more importantly is that, you know, at least I believe that there's a lot more that can be done in Central Florida with regard to conservation. You know, the best water that you can have is the water you don't use. You know, a number of us believe that there are things that can be done in Central Florida to increase water conservation, forestalling the day when you might have to think about taking water from the St. John's River. You know, and they're planning on additional water conservation, but I think there's a whole lot more that can be done.
And what are some examples of that?
Well, right now, they're looking at some of the low-hanging fruit which exists, but, you know, we think that, at least I think, that there are things that they can do. Water management districts can spend some of their money. They have cost-sharing programs. They can increase that cost-sharing program and earmark that towards water conservation and really put a lot of resources into water conservation to bump that number up. I think they're projecting 37 million gallons of savings by the year 2030. It's probably capable of being double or triple that.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the state's water wars this morning. What are your questions over Central Florida's plan to keep withdrawing more water from the St. John's River? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, Brian, the Riverkeeper objects to this, citing concerns about the impact to the river. Let's talk, too, about how other parts of the country are grappling with this issue. What happens when demand exceeds supply? California is sort of the poster child for what state officials really worry about. California dealing with a drought and huge drops in water flow for their Colorado River Basin. They are just going through a nightmarish problem when it comes to water. Does that keep you up at night when we look at water issues here in Florida?
Well, I think certainly California provides us a window into the potential future of Florida. No doubt that if we don't start getting a handle on our water consumption and how we use water, we could find ourselves in the same place. You know, it's kind of odd, a state to get 60 inches of rain a year, we're worried about water.
Yeah, and it's because of our aquifer at base, isn't it? Our aquifer is not as plentiful as it used to be.
Well, it's because we pumped the heck out of it over the last 100 years.
That's right. We've abused it. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say.
All right. Let's go to your calls. We are speaking right now with Brian Teeple of the Northeast Florida Regional Council. Massive growth and development down in the Orlando area means that Central Florida's water initiative is looking to withdraw hundreds of millions of gallons of water from the St. Johns River every day. And of course, here in Jacksonville, lots of objections to that. What do you think? Give us a call right now, 549-2937. Jim is on the west side of Jacksonville. Hey, Jim, how are you today? Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I've been wondering about desalination, and I grew up hearing that it was a very expensive process, but I also grew up always hearing about problems with areas not having enough water and having to use up the rivers. So I'm wondering what kind of option desalination is, and if it's not an option, why not? And even though Orlando's in the center of the peninsula, could they not draw water from either the ocean or the Gulf, or could not coastal towns use desalination and not use fresh water, even to include Jacksonville? Could Jacksonville not consider desalination? Does anybody have any information on that?
Jim, excellent question. That's Jim on the west side. Brian.
Desalination is clearly an option. It's hugely expensive. It uses a tremendous amount of energy, and then you have to deal with disposal of the brine afterwards. Desalinization clearly is part of the Tampa Bay water solution at this point in time. It was part of what settled those water wars down there. The problem is, and you mentioned, you know, couldn't the coast do desal and let the central part of the state, you know, do groundwater and surface waters? That would only work if you could normalize pricing. Is it fair for folks on the ocean to pay desal prices while Central Florida would just simply pay the cost of pumping water out of the aquifer?
So you don't see Florida necessarily going to that option?
Oh, I think at some point in time we'll have to go to that.
You do?
Option.
You think that is in the cards?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
Particularly in localized areas such as Tampa Bay.
Wow. Yeah. And when you look at California now, ordering its municipalities to cut water use by 25%. That just is, I think it's hard for people here in Florida to really get their heads around what that means realistically, the logistics of that, how that affects your daily life.
Well, you know, but in Florida, we have a real advantage. We could decrease 20% in our residential component pretty quickly because we all grow St. Augustine grass, and we mm-hmm. spend 50% of the potable water watering our lawns. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to water St. Augustine grass that I have to mow every week. We need to go to alternatives. Local governments need to come up with landscaping codes to limit the amount of St. Augustine grass, and we need to go forward with that.
And we're going to keep talking about how we can better conserve our water here in Florida as the state's water wars heat up. What are your questions? 549-2937. Lots of calls. Let's go to Mark on the west side right now. Hey, Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Just when you think there aren't any more reasons to hate Orlando, this pops up. a couple of questions. You know, I've been hearing that they're not even going to use a lot of this water from the St. Johns River for drinking, that is going to be used for I think they call it secondary uses, like golf courses and stuff like that. Not even for drinking water. Not that that makes it any better, but is that correct?
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, that's part of the theory, and it's really to supplant the use of potable water or drinking water on those uses. And it's also cheaper. I mean, if you pump water out of the St. Johns River and use it for non-potable water uses such as irrigation, you don't have to treat it to the level that you would if you put it in the pipes and it comes out the tap.
We do waste so much water, though. Here's a tweet from a listener. Is it true that we lose so much of our rainwater to runoff and evaporation? Why not capture more of it? We that's a very valid question.
Yeah, one of the things that, and I hate to keep going back to Tampa, but I think that's truly the poster child in Florida. You know, they have, reservoirs in the state of Florida are far and few between. It's not been part of our water resource strategy for a number of years. Take those high wet weather flows, store them on surface waters, and then use them during low-level flows. Those are options that, frankly, could be used and would be less detrimental than simply putting a pipe into St. John's and sucking out 150 million gallons every day.
And if you're just tuning in, the Central Florida Water Initiative does indeed want to withdraw up to 150 million gallons of water every day out of the St. John's River. That is sparking strong objections from our St. John's River Keeper, Mayor Curry, and other officials up here in Jacksonville. What are your questions about this? 549-2937. Let's go to Lynn in Green Cove Springs now. Hi, Lynn. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes. I was going to say, I think it looks pretty clear that the governor has sided with Central Florida on this and that he's removed Hans Tansler as the executive director of the Water Management District. He didn't reappoint Lant Daniels on the board, and North Florida is really losing the representation, and I think that the writing's on the wall here that the governor is giving a lot of way. Thank you.
Lynn, thanks for that. What about the politics of it? Brian Teeple, as she pointed out, Hans Tansler III, he did leave that body. He lives here in Jacksonville. Does North Florida just not have the political muscle to really have a voice in this fight?
Well, without speaking directly to those personnel changes, it's real clear, for example, in the Florida legislature that, you know, the legislators along the I-4 corridor, which is what we're talking about, have organized themselves. And they have, they get together periodically, they talk about issues that affect Central Florida and the I-4 corridor, and they have the numbers, and they're organized. I suggest that if we're going to have a chance in the legislature, our Northeast Florida, North Florida legislators need to get together and start talking to one another and working together more
closely. You think they need to be better organized?
That would be helpful, yes.
All right, and lots of calls on this. Whoa, it's a hot topic today. Florida's water wars. 549-2937, Jim in Jacksonville. Hey, Jim, what are your thoughts? Good morning.
Yeah, my comments are on the process of how this decision's been made, or not the decision, but just the process of examining this option for water. I happen to be at the only meeting that the Central Florida Water Initiative had here in Jacksonville. And at that meeting, they did not even bring up the withdrawal from the St. Johns River until the riverkeeper forced them to bring that up. So I just felt like that was disingenuous. The other piece of it is that any time at that meeting somebody brought up ideas like more conservation or even potentially limiting growth, their simple answer was, well, that's just not within our purview. So wouldn't it be better if we brought all those things in so that we would make a better decision looking at all the different options available?
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for those questions.
Well, I think Jim makes a good point. He's right. Central Florida Water Initiative had not engaged with Northeast Florida at all. Several of us have been very concerned about over time. We helped organize the meeting in which he talks about, and he's absolutely correct. Talked a lot about process and not about much of what they were doing. We've continued the conversation now, though, with the Central Florida Water Initiative. We're continuing to meet with them on an ongoing basis. We're trying to move the needle on their plans, but we're a little bit behind the game.
You're trying to work with them. You're pushing for less aggressive conservation goals, I think, than the St. John's River Keeper, correct?
Well, I'm not sure that we're pushing for less aggressive conservation goals. I think we have a different approach.
Okay.
I think the Riverkeeper suggests that regulation is the way to go, and that may be ultimately, but I'm the kind of guy who says, let's try to see what we can do before we have to regulate.
We'll go back to your calls in a moment. Oh, and are the lines jammed? Boy, our listeners care about the water. You know, you think these arcane topics aren't fascinating and hot topics, but they are. People are really engaged, and I love it. Here on the show this morning, we'll go to your calls in a moment, but first, here's an email from Stephanie in Avondale. She writes, where are the restrictions on lawn watering and upkeep of all the theme parks in Central Florida? Why would we discuss draining the St. John's before discussing our cultural waste of water on non-essentials? I'm uncomfortable with the environmental risk to the St. John's River just to support someone watering their lawns.
Well, that's a good point. You know, the Water Management District, St. John's River Water Management District, passed a rule, 2 days of watering during summertime, 1 day during the wintertime, and then asked local government to enforce it. You know, local governments' budgets are strapped. They have better things to do than do that. And my point is, if you're going to pass a regulation, you need to be about enforcing it.
Here's a tweet from Barbara. She tweets the show, "Water is the new gold." 549-2937. Catherine in Jacksonville. Hey, Catherine, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi, I've listened to a number of NPR shows about water use, both in Florida and nationally, and I've heard very little about the overwhelming impact of our dietary choices on water use, especially our growing of feed grains to feed animals so we could eat meat. And I was wondering if your guest had any comment on that topic.
Sure, Catherine. And in fact, in Central Florida, a flap over a cattle farming operation has recently made news in terms of water usage. What about that aspect of it, Brian Teeple?
Well, more important, or at least what I'm most familiar with, is the Tri-County Agricultural Area, which is St. John's, Putnam, and Flagler County. A lot of row crops down there. I'm good friends with a number of the farmers down there because I grew up on a dairy farm. They are moving towards water conservation. They're slow to move in that direction. They don't have a lot of money to do that. The Water Management District is helping them. So we're starting to see some changes in water use, at least in our row crops up here.
549-2937. We have calls from all over the listening area right now on the show. Jessica is in Riverside. Hey, Jessica, what are your thoughts right now?
Hey, so I'm an artist and a botanical sculptor, and so this really hits home with me because I look around and I see all of the St. Augustine grass growing, and I know what it's taking, and, you know, not just from the water, but also from the soil itself, and it just seems like such a waste. And we have all of these conversations about water capture and water runoff, and so I've been doing some personal experiments with tiered growth. And the conclusion that it's led me to is that if we change the expectation and the way that we're functioning, then we have a chance at changing and making something very beautiful and something that is also growing, that's functional, that's creating food, which is creating a different kind of a different function for our industry of, you know, buying vegetables and buying meat. And it's a very overall satisfying feeling to grow something yourself in your own area. And we all have these tiny plots of land that we grow seed on that goes to waste. And it's really kind of fascinating to see this kind of like totem of growth from rain runoff, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Thank you, Jessica. Brian Teeple, when we talk about the specifics of changes people around the state can make in terms of conservation, can we start talking about solutions? What are some examples of how we can approach this?
Well, one of the easiest things to do and the one that has the most immediate impact. You know, the last caller was from Riverside. I live in Avondale. We're an older neighborhood. Houses are 90 years old, but we're still building a lot of new subdivisions. And those new subdivisions, the last thing that happens is we roll out St. Augustine grass. We need to change our landscape ordinances, limiting that amount. And that's the easy thing to do because you're not asking folks to change their lifestyles or change and retrofit. Let's not continue to compound the problem with new growth. Growth is coming to the state of Florida. Let's plan for it and use our water resources more wisely in our landscaping codes.
And to achieve that logistically, that means calling up your city council person. That means making noise about it. That means going down to City Hall and raising that issue. That's something your organization is engaged in.
Yeah, there's a beautiful model that Volusia County has, and you can go on their website. They've really taken some forward steps in limiting the amount of St. Augustine grass in new construction. And anybody who's interested in that, just go to Volusia County's website and you can find it there. It's really a great approach. It's a good first step.
Have there been any steps made in Duval County in that regard, or St. John's, or Nassau, anywhere in this area?
None that is visible.
None yet. Okay. So long story short, for that to become a thing in Jacksonville, someone needs to take ownership of it, right?
That's correct.
Who will that be? Who is going to lead the way on this?
Well, it's going to have to be the political leadership. I mean, you know, laws are made by, in Jacksonville, of course, through city council and through the mayor. In my other communities, it's the county commissions and the city councils in those communities. They need to take ownership of it and move that ball forward.
Let's go now to Stephen in Jacksonville. Hey, Stephen, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning. I actually work for the city of Palatka in Putnam County, and I've heard a lot in the last few years. The local fishing guides catching a lot more redfish and other you would more likely see saltwater type fish and animals. And just wondering if, with what type of saltwater intrusion we have now, how much more encroachment we would have if we went and sucked more fresh water out of a river that already has a lot of these issues we're seeing.
Right. Thanks, Stephen. Here's another tweet about that. If we pump millions of gallons out and they also dredge the river, somebody tweets the show, won't that worsen saltwater intrusion?
I'm not an expert on that, but certainly in talking to Quentin White, who's a good friend, who is an expert on those sorts of issues, sure, we're going to have probably a saltwater wedge coming a little further up the river. What does that mean in the long term? Not really sure. We have right now a battle of science going on.
Have to wait and see.
Have to wait and see.
Eric on the south side. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Good morning. Brian, what are your projections for human population in Florida by 2050?
Double it.
Double population in our part of Florida or all of Florida?
Double in our area. We will double by the year 2050. You can roughly say that that's probably what we'll end up in the entire state.
Paint a picture, then, for our listeners. This area will be completely built out, correct? I know you've even done a model with little Legos to show people that reality check project you
correct.
Did a few years ago. Mm-hmm. What this area will look like and what the infrastructure demands and stresses will actually be.
Yeah, we need to, Florida has been a state of sprawl. That's how we've grown since, the 1920s. We need to be smarter about how we grow. We need to locate our growth centers in more strategic locations. We need to think about growing up and not out. There'll still be demands on some of our natural resources, such as water. Those we'll have to deal with into the future. And as I say, that California model, that does provide perhaps a window into the future.
When we look to in so many ways, California always seems to show the nation the future for good or for ill. Isn't that the truth? So right now we look at California and almost kind of shiver when we see these water problems they're having. Here's an email from Sean. What about desalinization efforts in the Netherlands? Are their methods cheaper and more efficient than the ones used in the U.S.? Would that work for us?
I'm not really familiar with what the Netherlands is doing. I will tell you that for a variety of reasons, a lot of things that Europe is doing on a number of fronts are much more progressive than we have done here in the United States. We could certainly take a lesson from what Europe has done, not only from land use patterns, but how they deal with recycling and other sorts of issues.
And here's another email from Marika. What about the use of gray water and the regulations preventing consumers from using gray water?
I foresee a time, and this is not going to be popular, that we'll have a closed cycle loop. We'll treat water in our wastewater treatment plants. We'll treat it to a high quality, and we'll stick it into the pipe for potable water.
So, obviously, our listeners are informed about this. They care a lot about it. What are your final thoughts about this for them as they're listening to you?
Well, I think it's encouraging that folks are involved in this issue. This is a long-term, long-range issue. Nothing bad is going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to affect me when I go home. It's not going to affect you when you go home. The world will continue to spin in grease grooves, but it's one of those things that is a long-term issue. It's hard to oftentimes get people excited about long-term issues. This one has captured their imagination.
We so appreciate you being with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Melissa.
Brian Teepel is Executive Director of the Northeast Florida Regional Council. Well, much more still ahead. Later, travel tips from our own Judy Wells. If you're heading overseas, she'll join us. But up next, helping local Hispanic college students achieve their dreams. We'll tell you how that's happening here on the First Coast right after this.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Franzen. His new novel, Purity, is in part about keeping and revealing secrets.
I'm in the business of betraying secrets about myself. I'm not going to tell you everything, but I'm going to tell you more than most people would tell the world.
Franzen's other novels include the bestsellers The Corrections and Freedom. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
This is Watch Officer Miller Norton with the Duval County Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable food, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
My name is Harry Reagan. I got hooked immediately because it's just the kind of radio station I've always been looking for and never found until now.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 or go online to wjct.org/relax for more information.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is Deputy Director of Middle Schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
Welcome back. Well, it's a chance for local college students of Hispanic descent to achieve their dreams. The First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce is accepting applications for a special scholarship. CEO Maribel Hernandez joins us now to tell us about the 2015 Achieving the Dream Scholarships. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. So this is for college students in our area of Hispanic descent, correct?
Yes, it is.
Tell us about it.
The Achieving the Dream Scholarship Program covers Hispanic students from the five counties in Northeast Florida, Baker, Nassau, Clay, St. John's, and Duval County. And it's a program that is very near and dear to my heart. My mom being the first high school graduate of the family and myself being the first college graduate, I have seen firsthand really how important education is. And unfortunately, Hispanics don't take advantage of that. According to a Pew study, there's about 18% Hispanics that are graduating from high school, 19% are enrolling in college, but unfortunately only 9% are actually graduating from college. Mm. So we really want to provide scholarships and opportunities for these students to achieve their dreams of a college education and open doors to a better life.
How can students apply? What are the criteria? How can they get the scholarship?
The scholarship is open to all Hispanic students or of Hispanic descent, third generation, so they do not necessarily have to be born in another country or be first generation, as long as a grandparent, one of their grandparents, is of Hispanic descent. And there's 20 countries of Spanish origin, including Spain, our motherland. And so there's definitely a lot of opportunities there. But they can apply going directly on our website, fchcc.com. And the criteria is primarily over half of the points or criteria of the scholarship have to do with financial need and academics. So they really have to have a need for this financially, but their grades also have to be up to par with those that we see as successful students and the probability of them completing the education. And then there's other criteria such as an interview, an essay, recommendation letters, and we certainly want to know what their awards and extracurricular activities are. They need to be really well-rounded, and we want to make sure that they also contribute to the community and see it as part of their role.
Now, Maribel, this is really timely because here in Florida, of course, there is a large Hispanic population, particularly in South and Central Florida. However, North Florida is becoming an increasingly diverse area as well, and the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce really reflects that growing diversity. Can you tell us a little bit more about the organization?
The First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce is about 23 years old, And our main focus is really to positively impact the community. We focus on advocating for and supporting the growth of Hispanic businesses, but the overall community as well. And so the scholarship program is the philanthropy work that we do. The primary mission for us is really to connect small Hispanic businesses with the large corporations that are also our members and really make sure that they have opportunities to grow and succeed in this community.
What was it like when it first started as to what this work is like today? Of over 23 years, that's longer than I realized that you've been in this area.
Yes. The Chamber has a very interesting history. When they were first created, it was actually Hispanic American Business Association. And it was created back in that time, there was what they called a minority set-aside program. I'm sure many of us know about that. And at the time, those that we call today sort of our Hispanic godfathers or the forefathers, the elders in the Hispanic community that are still here today and still widely respected and certainly mentors of mine, they started this organization because they did not see opportunities where Hispanic businesses were really even recognized as minority businesses, were being excluded. And they figured out that, you know what, let's not blame the community for this. Oh, woe is me. They said, part of that is really our fault because we're not united, we don't have a presence, and we don't have a voice. And so they came together and formed this organization. And through the years, back in about 15 years ago, they renamed the organization First Coast Hispanic Chamber because they really saw that the mission really was a lot bigger than just getting contracts. Obviously, getting contracts and having the opportunity to grow your business is very, very important. But our mission is much larger than that, in that we want to make sure the overall community, that Hispanics are heard and that they do have a voice in this community. And it's a great, great organization, very dear and near to me.
How long have you been involved with it?
I've been involved with them for about 10 years. I am a volunteer, so I'm not a paid position, paid staff position. I do this from my heart because it is something that is very important to me. And I absolutely see the growth in the Hispanic community. Certainly, it's not a secret that the Hispanic demographic is the fastest growing demographic in this entire country. In fact, the U.S. Census has us at about 16% Hispanic, but they're estimating that by the year 2060, currently there's about 50 million Hispanics. 2060, according to the U.S. Census, they're estimating 128 million Hispanics will make up the population of the United States. So as a community, even though in Jacksonville we're about 9% Hispanics, that is absolutely at the tipping point where it's going to really, really start to boom. And as a community, we really need to be prepared not only to do business, but also the organizations here really need to be prepared and recognize the value that Hispanic businesses bring to this community.
Overall, Jacksonville, I think, is a very welcoming and positive place to be. At the same time, it's been really fascinating to watch in recent months this incredible public dialogue on the campaign trail. As we watch candidates like Donald Trump talk about immigration and just the incredibly passionate responses it's generating. What are your thoughts when you see that dialogue taking place?
I think it's good that we have that dialogue. And I'm really pleased, you know, something good comes out of every situation. I choose to focus on the positive. I choose not to give energy to individuals that really don't see the good in others, that choose to look at the negative. But the Hispanic community and the culture is absolutely very, very rich, extremely valuable, and a big makeup of this country. And what I choose to focus on, which is what I'm glad that this is a dialogue, even though a lot of people see it as negative, is that it really has us talking about Hispanics overall. And it really has us talking about uniting and what value we bring to this country and how important we are as a demographic. And while, you know, my family's from Puerto Rico, I know the comments were made about Mexicans, and you would think that, well, Mexicans, I'm not Mexican. So there is that separation. I would never know in my life ever know what it's like to be a Mexican coming into this country for the American dream. I could never speak to that. But I was, what I was really pleased to see is that all Hispanics from all origins, backgrounds, and countries came together and said, no, you talk about one of us, you're talking about all of us. And it gives us a voice to really focus on the positive things that we are contributing to this country. And I'm glad that we're having that dialogue. I really am.
Tell me more about your family.
My family, I was born in New York, and so my friends down here call me a New Yorican. My Southern friends call me a Yankee, but that's a different interview. Puerto Rican, born in New York. And it's interestingly enough, the Puerto Ricans that were born in the island actually don't consider me a real Puerto Rican.
Oh, really?
But the Puerto Rican culture is very proud. We really are very, very proud of who we are and our heritage. And so to us, if you have 1% blood Puerto Rican, you are Puerto Rican. And that's our background. But my mom came when she was 5. And so how this relates to how education is important to me is because growing up in Puerto Rico, where her family did, it's similar to the South, where when you were in third grade, they pretty much pull you out of school and you go work in the farm. Mm. So of my mom's 5 siblings, she's the only one, and by saving grace that she came when she was 5 to New York, that actually graduated from high school. So college was not something that we talked about in my house at all. I don't remember ever talking about that, certainly not how to fund it. We didn't have a scholarship fund. My mom was just happy if I would graduate high school. That was her dream for me. However, when I came to Jacksonville, I was only 19 years old, and I started with the Jacksonville Port Authority. And I remember walking into the CEO's office back then and saying, you know, I could get used to this. What do I need to do to get your job? And he said to me 2 things that always stayed with me. He said, you need 2 things. He said, 1, you need experience, and you'll get that with time. And 2, you need this little piece of paper called a degree. And up until that very moment, at the age of 19, I never even thought about that as an option. And I said, you know what? I can do this. I'm going to go get that little piece of paper. I went to, back then it was FCCJ, now FSCJ, and I got my associates there. UNF, so yes, I'm an Osprey. UNF, I got my bachelor's degree, and I got my MBA at Concordia University and Montreal University. At the time, I was working with the airport, and their MBA program was focused on international aviation. And so I'm very, very fortunate that I have been very blessed with that education, and it's opened so many doors, and I really want that dream for other Hispanic students that may not even have those discussions in their homes. You will have a lot more options through an education. It's not required. It doesn't have to be something that has to be for everyone, but for those that want certain positions that do require a degree, it's yours to have. You can achieve that dream.
And so this is just a tremendous opportunity for people just tuning in. How can they learn more? How can students apply?
Students can apply through the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce site, fchcc.com, or call 346-1118 for more information. But we are currently on the back end of our process this year, and we'll be gearing up for next year. And so we have, for this year, have already selected 16 of the most fabulous students, high potential, extremely talented students. And on October 16th, we will be awarding those scholarships to those students at a luncheon that we're having, Achieving the Dream Scholarship Awards Luncheon, where we will also be celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month that starts September 15th through October 15th. And I certainly encourage everyone to please come to the event. All the proceeds from the event directly go into funding next year's scholarships. So depending on how much we raise, we'll determine how many scholarships we can award next year.
Well, you are living the dream, and it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Maribel Hernandez is president and CEO of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And we're back in a moment.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, if you're planning a trip overseas, there are certain tips to keep in mind depending on where you travel.
Roam if you want to, roam around the world.
For example, a formerly war-torn area like Cambodia and Vietnam is now a huge tourist attraction, but still, you need to be safe and be careful. Our regular contributor Judy Wells is just back from Cambodia and Vietnam and joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow. Fascinating. I mean, my dad's a Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. He dropped bombs over Cambodia. Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a 20-year-old fighter pilot. This is within my lifetime. I mean, and yours, of course. This is just incredible to me that now people are going there and touring the country.
And they welcome us.
And they love it.
The problem is that in Cambodia, that country lost 90% of its intelligentsia under Pol Pot and
that's
the killing
right.
fields.
That's right.
98% of their classical dancers were killed.
It's incredible.
It's incredible. And Vietnam, of course, has turned that around. Over there, they call it the American War. You get a whole new perspective doing this. And they have the War Remnant Museum in Saigon. And it hurts to see American planes, helicopters, equipment, weapons, gear, mm-hmm. uniforms on display by the victors. We have to remember
sure.
they won.
Sure, sure.
And of course, there's a great deal of propaganda involved in it. But there is one room that is so exceptional that features both the photography of the war from both sides, primarily life photographers and photographers from the Vietnamese. And you walk out of there and you are just awed by what it took and what was done covering that war, both fighting it and covering it.
So on your website, wellsworld.net, you have a list of must-see places in both of these countries. Let me begin by asking you about one of the top seven wonders of the world, the ruins of Angkor Wat in Cambodia.
Angkor Wat is and Angkor Thom, which turns out to be most people's favorite. It's the one that one part is being eaten by the trees.
Ah,
that you
right.
always see the photos
yeah,
of.
Yeah.
Are the remnants of the Khmer regime, the original Khmer regime, who named the country Kampuchea, Cambodia. And Kampuchea, and they still call it that. The people
do they
who live
really?
There.
Do
yes.
they?
Well, they know it's Cambodia. The world calls it Cambodia. To them, it's Kampuchea still. And these are the remnants of an amazing civilization in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, primarily. You get chills when you think about the glory that has crumbled and gone
mm-hmm.
and what is left and what man accomplishes.
And the jungle sort of reclaiming it.
Reclaiming it. Or they reclaimed it. It has been pushed back. It still keeps trying to grow forward, of course, as jungles do. Angkor Thom is much smaller in its spaces. It's several temples. And the king was in a hurry, so he didn't waste time with the quality of the limestone. And it's in much worse disrepair than is Angkor Wat, which is just spectacular. The amazing thing about Angkor Wat is they'll get 5,000 visitors a day, and it absorbs those people. And you still have areas in there where you feel alone and with this faded beauty. And the carvings are spectacular. The spaces are amazing. And there are ways for, as Emma Waterways refers to us as gentle walkers who don't want to climb four stories of crumbling stairs, to see what there is to see. And that's one of the reasons I was interested in Emma Waterways and the new ship, Amadera, that's the newest and largest by a meter and a half, plying the Mekong.
So you can cruise down the Mekong.
You can cruise down the Mekong. Now, you fly...
Forget about Colonel Kurtz going upriver. Sorry. I can't resist Apocalypse Now references.
Go.
You can cruise in style now.
You can... Yes, you cruise in very nice style. In fact, if you want to feel incredibly privileged and fortunate, see a third world country in a first-class riverboat.
Well, let me talk about that, because this is a third world country. And whenever you travel to a third world country, not only do you have to be cautious, you have to be respectful of the fact that you're traveling amongst poor, disenfranchised people.
Yes. And one of the things I really, very much liked about this cruise is that as we traveled, you have to bus from Cambodia down to where you came from Siem Reap to where you catch the boat. And en route, these excellent guides give you an insight into the country, in the area you're going to be cruising through in Cambodia. And then when you do the same thing going, when you hit Vietnam, a Vietnamese guide tells you about this. They're not going to tourist areas as a rule. You see, this is the difference between river ships and cruise ships. You see the way the people live.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners of Emma Waterways, who were with us on this inaugural cruise, Rudy and his wife, Christine, travel every year to the areas where they have ships looking for new places to take their guests that are off the main tourist route. And so everything is up to date. You always have surprises. We met, for example, survivors of the killing fields. We were allowed to photograph or tape Buddhist monks at prayer. I was invited to join the nuns at the Buddhist center and feed the monks their afternoon meal.
So this wasn't like a trip to Paris or a trip...
It's not like
a trip
to Paris.
I mean, this is a much more serious trip.
And that's, I think, river ships concentrate more on the culture, mm-hmm. the history, the culture, and the current way of life, bringing you up to date on where these people's situation, this country's situation, than cruise ships where take you someplace to have fun.
I guess it's hopeful, though, to think about the fact that after this horrific war and the horrors of the Pol Pot regime, that the human spirit does somehow triumph and that tourism has actually come back in these countries.
It has, and it's helping support a lot of people. We brought back a lot. You know, everybody brings back souvenirs, beautiful silks and wood carvings and that sort of thing. But I will remember longest and have longest is the respect for these people who smile despite not having enough to eat every day, who are working so hard to improve themselves and their country. And they, both sides come from horrible situations, and they're making the best of the present. I think Vietnam is going to have the harder row to hoe, although it's better financially, because, for example, in Saigon, 60% of its population is 35 and under.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a very volatile age group.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize quickly that the communist model does not work economically. And so they've gone to a free market economy. And yet the government still has loudspeakers in the cities and broadcasts propaganda daily. And the younger people tune this out. Well, once they get more money and more comfort, they're going to want to get rid of that. I can see a turmoil coming. A number of us could. We're going to be watching it closely.
Judy Wells, you are so much more than a travel expert. You are one of the most fascinating people I know. Do you know that?
I'm nosy. I mean, the newspaper paid me to ask questions my mother would have spanked me for.
Where are you off to next?
I'm going to stay here for a while.
Oh, well, there you go. How about you're going to take a little rest? Go to wellsworld.net to learn all about travel to Cambodia and Vietnam. And thanks for being
here. If you want to know more, go to allthingscruise.com. I posted as I went along. There are 14 stories from the time I left Jacksonville to the time I returned.
Always good to see you.
Good to see you too, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Meanwhile, subscribe to our podcast. It's now on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama travels to Alaska to call for global action on climate change, but critics say Arctic drilling authorized by the Obama administration undercuts that goal. Addressing global climate change, the future of Arctic drilling, and a president's legacy, that's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.